All right, West Coast, Jeff Johnson here. We're discussing already, and I just about missed my cue. I'm joined in studio here by Jackie Wind. I'm gonna let you introduce yourself because I've introduced you a couple of different ways in the past. I think it's all been good, but I'd like to hear how you set yourself up.
Well, that's putting me on the spot, but all
right.
Yeah, I think a lot of people in the community know me. I am interested in a lot of things, so a lot of people know me as a photographer and writer. Mm-hmm. And I think a fair few people know that before that I worked as a geologist. I have a PhD in geology, mm-hmm. and my specialty is structural geology, which is the study of folds and faults and fractures in the earth crust that are caused by plate tectonics. So, of course, when one of those things moves, that's an earthquake. So that's really closely related to what I did my PhD in. So
okay.
It's not, you know, I've got both my concern for the local community, which mm-hmm. people know I speak out about in a lot of ways, but I also have this very specific knowledge yeah. about earthquakes and faulting and the effects of them.
So you have that background. Let's open with some background conversational here. We're talking about what was in 1700 referred to as the Cascadia earthquake, or that's what how they refer to it now. I guess, how do we know, first of all, that this occurred in 1700, and what's the history behind the development? How did it occur, and how did it affect our region?
Well, it's a really interesting thing how people know exactly. Today, the reason, we should mm-hmm. actually say, the reason we're talking about this mm-hmm. Today is the 310th anniversary of mm-hmm. that earthquake. It happened on January 26th at 9 o'clock p.m. Mm-hmm. in the year 1700. And as most people know, that was long before there was any European settlement here. Of course, there were lots of native communities mm-hmm. here, but they didn't have a written record. So they've
yep.
passed down in their communities this oral history
yep.
of this big earthquake, and it wiped out a village on Pachina. They've got a very specific oral history of it, which you can kind of back calculate how many generations ago,
mm-hmm.
but there's no exact date to it. They say the shaking happened at night in winter.
Yeah.
So scientists have been doing studies, geologists mainly, mm-hmm. and one of the big things they did is they did mud cores in the mud flats. So they just get a little auger and they core down and pull out these layers of mud from the mud flats.
Mm-hmm.
And Browning Passage right here, just
yep.
up the inlet from Tofino, is one of the key places where they did these studies. And other places that people will know up and down the coast, like Canham Lake between Hot Springs and
mm-hmm.
Heshquit Harbor, is another place where they've done these studies, because that's a really low-lying lake right behind the beach. So the tsunami flooded that lake.
With sediment from the ocean.
Yeah, so whenever a tsunami wave comes up the inlet, it's a big turbulent wave, and it's carrying a lot of sand with it,
mm-hmm.
and that sand gets thrown up on the mud flats, and you guys all know what a mud flat looks like. It's
mm-hmm.
got eelgrass and algae and stuff, and that sand comes up and kills what was underneath it on the mud flat, and scientists can carbon date that stuff, that decaying organic matter. They can carbon date it, which gives an exact date of when that sand layer was deposited, which
yep.
is the date of the tsunami and the earthquake. I guess I can't say an exact date
yeah.
because there's always
precise,
an error
yeah.
error margin on it. So they found that the highest up sand level, they found there's not just one. They've augured down and found quite a few of them. The highest up one was from the year 1700, but with an error bar plus or minus 20 years
mm-hmm.
on the carbon date. So they go, okay, so we know it was give or take 300 years ago that last one happened.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other ones below it that the dates all came out roughly 500 years apart. There's
yeah.
range. It could be as little as 200 and a little as much as 900.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a range in there. But it's on average every 500
yeah.
years. So then, I don't remember the exact location, but it was somewhere on southern Vancouver Island. They found all of these trees that had been knocked over at the same time in the same direction by some major event. And by doing dendrochronology, which is counting tree rings. So, you know, if you look at a cut tree
yeah.
trunk, you can see there, you might see there are four skinny ones
yeah.
and then five fat ones and two skinny ones.
And those are...
They relate to the seasons.
Yeah, the growth, how good the growth season was based on elements and what have you.
Exactly. So it means if you find a tree, a living tree today that's 400 or 500 years old, it'll have those growth rings from
mm-hmm.
that time period. So you can start working out the pattern. What was the climate pattern year by year by
mm-hmm.
those trees? By correlating with those dead trees and matching up the patterns, they can use those dead trees and work out they all died in the same year.
Mm-hmm.
They all died in the winter of 1699-1700. So they've got it constrained now that
yeah.
that carbon date, plus or minus 20 years, now they know it was winter of 1699-1700.
Yeah.
And then they went to Japan, where there has been a written culture there mm. for, I'm not sure exactly, but millennia, I think,
yeah.
definitely centuries. And they've been recording the arrival of tsunamis there in Japan for
yeah.
hundreds of
years. The orphan tsunami or whatever they referred to this particular one?
Yeah, Yeah, because it didn't have a known parent. Normally, a tsunami in Japan, there'd be an earthquake and then a tsunami. Mm-hmm. But they had this big tsunami come in with no earthquake. So obviously, it was from an earthquake far away. And that tsunami came in on January 26th. And when scientists back calculate how long does it take for a tsunami wave to travel across the Pacific, they came up with 9 p.m. January 26th. So is this really, really cool detective work?
Yeah, that's CSI stuff, Hollywood kind of, well, but obviously real world science. That's pretty neat.
Yeah, see, people who think geology is boring, this is why I think it's so cool.
I think that's pretty fascinating. So you said this, the evidence from the sediment deposits indicate about a 500-year cycle, or between 2 and 900 years, depending on the various things, but averaging out 500 years, which means that we're kind of getting into kind of the orange-red zone of it is a cycle, I guess, is what we should explain to people. It's about motion of the plates and how they're moving. They're moving at a pre-prescribed rate and whatever. So in our lifetime, it's quite feasible that we could see another one of these large-scale earthquakes in the region.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I think there's a really natural human tendency of, you think of what happens in your lifetime is normal, and what happens outside your lifetime is like, oh, this amazing freak event. Geologists are trained to think differently. We're trained to think on scales of thousands to millions or even billions of years. If you think about it, it's on average every 500 years.
Yeah.
The last one was 310 years ago today.
Yeah.
So there's an average is just an average. Earthquakes, you can't ever predict the date. You can just predict what's the average. So it means there's a 50% chance it's going to come before and a 50% chance it's going to come after. So 190 years from now, the 500 years will be up.
Yeah.
That means there's a 50% chance that's going to come in the next 190 years, which you divide all of that up, it means there's a 10% chance that it's going to come in the next 40 years.
Yeah. Which is enough to get concerned about.
Yeah,
enough to be aware of and maybe maximize or minimize rather the threat and the potential damage to yourself and to people here on the island and on the West Coast.
It's like I take it as, okay, there's a 90% chance it's not going to come in my lifetime.
Yeah. But rather the threat and the potential damage to yourself and to people here on the island and on the West Coast.
It's like I take it as, okay, there's a 90% chance it's not going to come in my lifetime.
Yeah.
But 10%, it's not like it's a 0.01%. It's still a 10% chance it is. And the implications of it coming are so serious, as we can see in Haiti. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing, is our earthquake is going to be 10 to 100 times stronger than the Haiti quake. Mm-hmm. And this is why I'm talking about it now, is I know people don't like talking about bad things.
Yeah.
But not talking about it doesn't mean it's not going to come. Mm-hmm. It's just, it's our choice whether we want to think about it, plan for it, and prepare for it or not. And that's, I'm not a negative person. I'm just a person who thinks ahead and cares about things happening. And that's why I'm talking about it.
All right. Well, we talk about, I'm going to kind of play the devil's advocate here a little bit. You talk about the strength, the relative strength of the Haitian earthquake. And I just think from where the epicenter of an earthquake occurs. In this case, it was right in a densely populated, developing nation. I look at the population density out here, and I don't see the potential for the loss of life being quite as big a deal. I know that's just a statistic thing. A loss of my life is just much more important than the loss of, sadly, millions of strangers' lives, because I'm a selfish dude that way. But How could even a massive earthquake like that equal the destructive force, of something in a more densely populated area?
Okay, we need to think of the scale of the plates. This is not a Tofino-Ucluelet earthquake. This is the Cascadia subduction zone, which goes right from the north end of Vancouver Island, even a bit north of there, south of the Charlottes. This subduction zone extends all the way down through Vancouver Island, all of Washington State, all of Oregon, and Northern California. So this earthquake is not just going to hit like Tofino and Ucluelet and Bamfield. It's going to be destroying Victoria. Vancouver is a bit more in, but Vancouver will be affected by it too. It's going to be destroying Victoria, Seattle, Portland. All these places are going to experience serious damage, depending exactly where the epicenter is. And this plate boundary, people think of things really on maps. Mm-hmm. So if you look at the plate boundary on a map, it's 75 kilometers offshore. But you got to think of the plate boundary in 3D. The plate, the oceanic plate, is going under the continent. Mm-hmm. So it's actually 25 kilometers straight below us right now. So the epicenter could be that close, 25 kilometers away. It's not a dot on a map. It's a point in space, in 3D space. So it depends exactly where the epicenter it is. And the other thing is, our earthquake is going to be 10 to 100 times stronger. Mm-hmm. The Richter scale is logarithmic. So going from an a seven
exponential
increase. Going from 7 to 8 means 10 times as strong, okay. not one yeah. point stronger. Going from 7 to 9 is 100 times as strong. And the last earthquake, the last big one here,
was a nine.
Yeah, and they're the biggest kind of earthquake we can have on the planet. The biggest earthquake ever measured, was I think it was a 9.1. It was just over a 9 in southern Chile.
All right, so I was going to say if, but I suppose when this geological event takes place, what do you perceive as the effects here on the coast for, I'm going to say on the coast for us specifically here in the Pacific Rim, and what do you think can be done, you know, to prepare ourselves and prepare future generations for the reality of this eventually occurring?
Well, with this, the recent horrible events in Haiti have really got me thinking these last couple of weeks. As you hear things that are going on, you know, I'd been thinking about what is the earthquake going to mean for us for years. But once you start hearing the news coming out of Haiti, you realize there are a lot of other things. Like, you know, they're talking about the looting and the violence in the street and people who don't have food and water. Well, that's going to happen here. Of first of all, imagine there's major destruction in the big cities, as well as just places bigger than Tofino, like Port Alberni and Nanaimo.
Where so that density is and that extra human element is,
Yeah, so where are aid efforts going to be concentrated? They're going to be concentrated on the big cities, not on the little ones. And we found that out in that windstorm a couple of years ago, where who was last on the list to get help? Bamfield. Who was second last? Tofino. So that was a really minor event compared to what this earthquake is going to be. So we're going to be really low down on the aid list. We only have one road out of town. And, you know, visualize that road in your head. It's not just going to be trees down. They're going to be landslides across the road. So our road is going to be cut off for sure for weeks and maybe for months. There's, you know, there's going to be, like in Haiti, there are going to be years of efforts of digging things out. And Highway 4 is not going to be number one on their list to get reactivated again. So Tofino will be cut off. You know, who knows exactly? I'd say for weeks, but possibly even for months cut off from help. And yeah, there will be helicopters and planes flying around, but they're only limited resources and they're going to be focusing on the denser population areas.
And I was reading actually in you've got a blog where you discuss this and other issues. It's jacquelinewind.com. You were talking about the seasonal issues, of course, in Haiti, where buildings are damaged, people are sleeping in the streets, which is fine in the summer in a tropical environment, but would be quite awkward in the winter here in Canada, and particularly difficult in the summer if things are all cut off and we've got 20,000 tourists in the streets of Tofino and a bunch in Ucluelet all without shelter, even in the summer, without shelter and food to get that much supply in, without a road and with shipping, you know, docks washed away in a tsunami and what have you would be. An additional crisis that I think we can't possibly really prepare for with the small infrastructure that we
have. Exactly. And those are some of the things that that the Haiti example has really made me think of, to think, well, not all of the houses are going to be destroyed. You know, the scale of the shaking is another thing for people to really be aware of, that it's going to be, each shake is 2 to 3 meters across. It's not like a vibration or anything. It's like literally like someone, you know, having a big rug underneath your house and shaking it back and forth 9 or 10 feet each shake for 2 to 3 minutes. So, you know, it depends on the house, which ones are going to be standing and which ones aren't. But I was thinking before Haiti, I was thinking, but some houses will still be standing and people, even if they're cracked and damaged, people can go back in. But what I hear from Haiti is with all the aftershocks and the damaged buildings, people are terrified to go back in, which will probably be the case here. And I had never thought of that before. So we'll even have buildings, whatever buildings are left standing, people aren't going to want to sleep in them, because what if there's an aftershock in the middle of the night and it comes down on them? So yeah, we're not in a warm climate like Haiti. Imagine if it came in winter. Even in summer, it's pretty cold to be sleeping outside in Tofino if you don't have the right gear with you.
Well, you're getting
but
wet.
In winter, it's pretty cold to be sleeping outside in Tofino if you don't have the right gear with you.
Well, you're getting
wet. In winter. And then what if it happens? There's another what if. What if it happens in summer? Thinking, well, how much food should we have stockpiled? You know, some people say 3 days, some people say 7 days. I'd say here in Tofino, for sure, weeks of food. And, you know, for sure, weeks of food. But then I was thinking, well, what if it happens in the summer when we have 20,000 extra people in town? How much food should we have stockpiled then? Whose responsibility is it to stockpile food for the tourists? Should the town do it? Should the resorts do it? How do we make sure we've got enough food for people? There are a lot of things that need to be talked about, and no one's talking about them.
Okay, well, we're getting on to that point then. What are, you had a couple of comments earlier that you made about to me before we got on the air here about preparedness and things that we can do or things that that groups could do unorganized, maybe becoming more aware about where the actual tsunami safety line is, assuming that the earthquake isn't the primary concern and people end, well, it will be a primary concern, it will be a large concern, but the primary concern is the ensuing tsunami. I think people's awareness of that is a little limited about where what is actually potentially safe in the tsunami situation, what the water levels would be, and how to respond.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we had, I don't really know if we even still have an emergency preparedness committee because we haven't heard anything from them for about 3 years. 3 years ago, and you know, I don't want to say anything against the people involved. I really appreciate that they are volunteering their time to do it, but at the same time, this is a big, serious thing, and we need people who are really informed and specialists in the matter. Volunteers can work with them, for sure, but volunteers who aren't trained in it shouldn't be making the critical decisions on it. And that's, well, I wrote a series of articles for our community 3 years ago because I was really concerned about a lot of the advice that was being given, like grab-and-go kits with 200 and some items. How are you supposed to run away with that? It's like the difference between what stuff do you need to survive the first 12 hours of the earthquake compared to what stuff do you need to survive the coming week. So it's not like the photos in Haiti where you see these big ripped out rebar and concrete buildings that pancaked down that you'd never be able to get dig your food out. Here we got houses built out of cedar and whatever, and we have, you know, if your food is stockpiled and unless you're in the tsunami zone itself, but if you're above the tsunami zone, we'll have lots of time to be digging through the rubble and finding your tinned corn and whatever you've got put away in there. So we need really clear advice of the different reasons for why do you stockpile things like the grab-and-go kit by the door, especially if you live in the tsunami zone. You need to get out of it right away. So you need to just be something you can grab at the door, which I'd say would be something like a tent, a power bar, a water bottle, some warm clothing, and you just run with it and get up to the higher level. And that's the other big thing that I had a problem with some of the advice, is that geologists have figured out chances are the most likely wave height for a place like Tofino, not places like Port Alberni, where, as you were saying, the waves get funneled up an inlet, but open places like Tofino, it'll probably be a 6-meter wave. So let's assume that 6-meter wave comes at high tide. So theoretically, the safe ground is 6 meters above the high tide line, which is not actually that high. Like when you first turn, I surveyed the height on Lynn Road. When you first turn into North Chesterman's on Lynn Road, and the peak, the highest point on Lynn Road right there, like about 100 meters from the highway, is 5 meters above the high tide line there. So it's not actually that high. And then the scientists are saying, well, we think 6 meters, but we want to err on the side of the caution. So let's add 50% to that and say 9 meters. And then there's the fact that the ground will probably subside about a meter during the earthquake. So add one more meter, and that makes 10 meters, is what scientists, including a margin of error,
so for our old Imperial friends, that's about 33 feet.
And then our local emergency crew said, well, let's just err on the side of caution and add 50% to that and call it 15 meters. But the scientists already added their error margin. And in some places, that wouldn't matter. But in a place like Tofino, and especially a place like Chesterman's Beach, going from 10 to 15 meters rules out almost every place.
Yeah, it changes your distance from a walking or running distance to something that, in the amount of time that you would have, would require like a car or
quick bicycle. The official advice for someone who lives, say, in South Chesterman's, the official advice is they're either supposed to go to the school, which is 5 kilometers, 5 or 6 kilometers away, or go out to the airport, which is, I don't know, 12 or something like that kilometers away.
On roads that have just been ravaged by an earthquake.
Yeah. So one tree down destroys the evacuation plan.
You got cars backed
there.
Up all the way to,
it's over. And there'll probably be a real lot of trees down. So someone who's living around South Chesterman's, they could run up to Rosie Bay and save their life. It's not like they need to be there for weeks. They need to be there for the next 12 hours while the tsunami waves are coming in. And then they can go back and check out and see what's left of their house. But they don't need to be there the whole time. They can make their way later on to Long Beach or the airport to be around the emergency crews. Yeah. So it's just that kind of advice. And that's why I wrote those articles, because I felt that the advice that we were being given was actually putting people in more danger, both the amount of stuff to carry, the type of stuff to carry, and where to go was putting people in more danger and would actually cost people's lives. I've never heard a response from those articles. Yeah. And I've posted them. I've posted both on my own blog, which is jacquelinewynn.com, I've posted just information about the earthquake itself, about how scientists know, and the stuff about coring the mudflats. And then on the Tofino Residence blog, which if you just Google Tofino Residence, you'll find it. Mm-hmm. Then I've posted a lot more about this, comparing our situation to Haiti and some of our preparedness issues. And I've posted links to both of those articles that I wrote for the community 3 years ago. So they're also, again, just going into a lot more detail about what my issues with our emergency planning are. And, you know, it's 3 years later, we've learned a lot from Haiti. There's a lot I would update those with, which I've kind of addressed on the Tofino Residence blog.
Cool. Well, I think that covers most of the things we discussed beforehand regards to this. I guess if it, like she said, like Jacqueline said, jacquelinewynn.com is her blog, and then there's the Tofino Residence blog as well with more information and more insight onto this thing. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we...
Just the Tofino Residence blog. People can also comment and ask questions on it. And there's a whole bunch of stuff. I've created that blog, the Tofino Residence blog, for our community to discuss a whole bunch of issues, whether it's community events or water or earthquake preparedness or music festivals or anything. Yeah. And every single article in there has room for people to comment on it. And I really urge people to go there and promote some discussion on these, and if people have other issues they want to raise on it, I've opened it up to lots of people. If you want to raise anything on the Tofino Residence blog too and open up a new discussion on a new topic, so just
groovy. Okay, well, thanks a lot for joining us, Jackie. We're talking about today being the 310th anniversary of, I guess, the most recent massive earthquake through our region.
And 9 p.m. tonight, have a thought for the anniversary.
Yeah, that's actually good. That's
kind of, think of it like Remembrance Day. It's not like a celebration kind of commemoration. Yeah. It's just, it's a thing that we should still think about.
Absolutely.